It's my privilege to introduce to you Rabbi Shalom Carmi. Rabbi Carmi is the editor of Tradition. He teaches philosophy and Jewish studies at Yeshiva University, where he's a tenured professor. He was selected by Rav Soloveitchik to edit his writings. He's edited Worship of the Heart. He's presently completing a second volume on prayer. He edited Modern Scholarship and Study of Torah, Contributions and Limitations, and also Jewish Perspectives on the Experience of Suffering. That was part of the Orthodox Forum series. Those of you who, like myself, have been reading Rabbi Carmi for many years know that he's a very unusual, creative, out-of-the-box thinker. He's published widely on biblical thought, on halacha and philosophy, on Rav Kook, Rav Soloveitchik, Torah and liberal arts. In fact, anything that his very nimble mind can attach to and turn into for the subject of Torah and holiness. Won't you welcome Rav Shalom Carmi?
It's the first time I've ever been in this building. At the same time, there is a kind of closing of a circle in my being here today. The Rav of this congregation, 50 years ago, from 1953 to 1967, Mori Verabi, Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, one of the greatest and most faithful Talmidim of the Rav, a period of many, many years. His first Rabbanut was in Boston because the Rav wanted him to be in Boston. He wanted to have him around him for more years, and he came here and ended his career in New York, where he was my teacher. By rights, he is a person who should be speaking about the Rav's machshava. I felt during the preparation of the film, which you saw yesterday, I frequently felt very badly that this unusual and prominent and faithful Talmid was not around to participate. Rabbi Wurzberger also was a person in 1976 who started pressuring the Rav to do more about taking care of his literary legacy. And the Rav said, you know, I really need somebody who's fairly competent in terms of Gemara, in terms of philosophy, can write decent English, to work on it with me. And it was Rabbi Wurzberger who said, well, what about Carmi? And I wasn't present, but apparently the Rav's response was positive, and a part of my life that almost seems inevitable at this stage was born in that moment. I once heard from Rabbi Wurzberger, it's time that a journalist from New York Times, a man named Pat Spiegel, well-known religion writer, had a long interview with the Rav. And it started at a certain point, and halfway through, they took a break. Spiegel walked out, and Rabbi Wurzberger, who knew Spiegel for a while, asked him, "Nu, how's it going?" And Spiegel said, "I never met a man who can take the simplest question and make it so complicated." And I don't remember if it was Rabbi Wurzberger or I who said, "And we have never known a man who can take the most complicated thing and explain it clearly." Which one it's going to be in the next hour, going to take simple things, make them complicated things, make them simple, I suspect a little bit of both. But let's get started. Start biographically. Came to Yeshiva University, was 15, 16, and I got a hold of Isha Halacha, halachic man. The Lonely Man of Faith was also available at that time. And I read his pieces. The Lonely Man of Faith, I have written that I didn't really read it, I inhaled it. And I was, you know, it seemed to answer many important needs on my part. There was one question among many, though, that remained after I had studied Ishalacha. And after I went through it the second time, was an older fellow in the yeshiva, Menachem Kasten, if you remember him, who took me under his wing, and we, I remember in June, we read the piece together. And the problem that bothered me, or I would, using Rav's lingo, it bothered my mind. The problem that bothered me is, where exactly in Ish HaLacha does the Rabbana Shel Olam come in? Because Ish HaLacha is not really about God. It's about halachic man. And the Rav is very open at the beginning of the essay. He says, there is this religious type, this type that is very important for understanding philosophy of religion, halachic man, and it's a lacuna in the philosophy of religion, or phenomenology of religion, sociology of religion. The people who have written on religion don't really know anything about this personality type, and therefore are unable to deal with it. And in parentheses means they're unable to deal with Yiddishkeit, because they're leaving that out. But in the opening of the piece, he's much more objective, that they can't, they don't know about this. They know about cognitive man. They know what it means for person or personality type, an abstract personality type. You focus on science, on knowing. They know what religion is about, religion defined as a yearning for something beyond this world. But they don't really know what this halachic personality is all about. Many, many years later, there was a man that I was friendly with named Tzvi Kolitz, who should rest in peace. Was today primarily known as the author of a short story called Yossel Rakover's Letter to God in the Warsaw Ghetto. Kolitz wrote a book about the Rav called Confrontations. And there was a haskama, there was a blurb on the cover from a professor at Harvard Divinity School named Harvey Cox. Cox says, I like this book because this book helped me to understand my colleague, Professor Tversky, whom I previously found odd. Now, I assume that what Cox meant was that the combination of a fervent religion with a meticulous observance of halacha and of an emotional piety with a very intellectualized approach was something that he had trouble relating to, and that this book helped him understand. But when I read Ish HaLacha, I was asking myself, where does the Rabbana Shel Olam fit into all of this? Of course, you take footnote 4, the famous footnote 4 in Ish HaLacha, where the Rav says, the halachic man is even more complicated than religious man, because halachic man has all of the tensions of religious man plus his own particular contributions. Which means clearly the halachic man includes within him religious man. And a few other places in the essay, the Rav talks about that. But if you ask me, what exactly is this about? It's not particularly clear, and in much of the essay, the Rav is very anxious to show the ways in which halachic man is different from religious man, from the mystic, from the person who's yearning for something beyond this world. There was also the question, where does the Rabbana Shel Olam fit in here? And without asking that question, one is liable to fall into a view that reduces religion to behavior. Precisely the view that the Rav talked about, that you saw up on the screen before when he speaks about how he was successful in teaching people Torah, halacha, but the experiential elements were harder to give over. We have a generation now, people who, he says in a part that was not put up on the screen, people who are extremely committed to practical behavior, sometimes, it upsets even fanatically so, but who don't have the emotion. And you get this in two versions, two flavors. You can get the people, the so-called right wing, where you have religious behaviorism with a very high standard of behavior, and you can get a more the more liberal version where it's religious behavior with lower, with minimalistic standards. But either way, you're thinking in terms of the behavior. As long as they do what I'm obligated to do, and if you're an intellectual, as long as they study what I'm obligated to do, as long as they play the intellectual game in learning, obviously for the Rav, learning Talmud is not an intellectual game, but it can turn into one for people, I'm okay. If you read Ishalacha to the end, in the second half, there are passages where the Rav seems to be moving towards answering the question that I would have wanted him to deal with, where he talks about creativity as an act of imitating God. There's some passages in that regard. If we're doing a literary analysis, I would go into that in detail, but we're obviously not going to do that now. Based on those passages, based on my own imagination, I tried to imagine what would the completion of Ishalacha be. Menachem Kasten, who was older than me, and he knew the ropes, and he said to me, you should know, there's a sequel to Isha Halacha called Isha Elokim, the man of God. It's true. That sequel today is what we would call the essay Vikashta Misham. And I don't go into the problem that I once heard debated by Rabbi Lichtenstein, Rabbi Lamb, who go back all that way, whether Uvikashtem is the final version of Isha Elokim, or whether Uvikashtem is an essay which incorporates everything from Isha Elokim that I've wanted to preserve. Uvikashtem raises that question. And again, I believe on literary grounds that this is the way things were set up to begin with. The draft of Isha Elokim was around in the 40s. There are literary connections between the two. Unfortunately, and I think it's a misfortune perhaps for the community as a whole, Uvikashtem did not get into print until 1978. There was a 35-year gap between Isha Elokim and Uvikashtem. And that gap reinforced the tendency to think of the Rav as a thinker who focuses in purely behavioral terms or purely intellectual terms. People then said in Long Man of Faith, well, he changed, and there are changes, but the changes are not quite that radical because there were earlier writings out there which were much more out in the open in this regard. Why it wasn't published? Well, everybody talks about the Rav's perfectionism. On a couple of occasions, he said to me that he did less in this area than he had wanted to, partly because he didn't think there was that much of a response to it. It's a very depressing statement. And he wrote less than he had intended to because it wasn't too much, nobody's really cared about this. And that might be why he delayed publishing some of this material as well. In any event, what I want to discuss with you is the structure of Uvikashtem Misham. I suspect that there are many, almost everybody here knows what Isha Elokim is vaguely about. I imagine that there are people here who read it. Uvikashtem, I suspect there are many fewer people who read it, partly because it's Hebrew and it's difficult Hebrew, partly because it's been around for only 25, 30 years, so people have not yet had the chance to write term papers on it, create cliff notes where Isha Elokim, you know, you don't have to read it, you already can hear from the grapevine what. You can make judgments about it without having read it. Say whatever you please. Uvichashtem is about man's relationship with God. Now, the opening shot of Uvichashtem is an assertion. Well, it begins with an analysis of Shir HaShirim, which I'm going to skip right now, even though it's very valuable. But it starts with an assertion. It's not an assertion about halacha, it's not an assertion about yahadut, it's an assertion about human beings. That human beings search after God. There is such a thing as man searching for something beyond everyday experience. How does this search take place? What are the realms, the arenas in which it takes place? The Rav is fairly open about these realms. In effect, he just goes through the history of philosophy and takes any area in which people have searched for God and views it as a legitimate arena in which that search can take place. The cosmos, the world of physics, the biological world, the realm of pure logic, so-called ontological proof, the various antinomies and peculiar aspects of human culture and aesthetics. Religious experience. It's very interesting that religious experience, in the conventional sense, is classed as man's experience of God. It's part of human culture that people have certain experiences, mystical experiences, and those experiences lead them in a religious direction. Those are facts. The kind of experience he's describing here need not necessarily lead a person to traditional religion. I mean, he's writing here could be compatible with, you know, Buddhism. It could be compatible with a person simply having a religious feeling. You know, the people around today who say, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. I mean, there's some kind of yearning which has no particular object. But that is one building block. It's a fact about human beings that people search for God in these areas. Now, let me digress for a moment. There has much been said about the Rav's view of secular studies. And he certainly indulged himself, was very broadly read and studied these areas. He, in some cases, urged students very much to go to graduate school to learn these things as well. On the other hand, people say there's no place where he says it's a mitzvah to go to college. Somebody in New York likes to say that I've never used the word Toromada. Now, but that's a simple reason. Rav didn't use political slogans. Didn't use cliches. But he did not make public speeches about how important it is for people to get degrees or be in a dean's list. I'm told that there was one drush in the 50s where he did speak more explicitly about these matters, but I haven't heard the drasha, and I'm not quite sure what's on it. What he was very much in favor of, as a part of Yahadut, not just as advice to one individual or the other, was that the search for God is part of what Yahadut is about. You look for God wherever you can. Different people have different capacities. Means one person may look for God in physics, one person may look for God in the humanities. But the notion is that if you are a human being, and if you have a spark of life in you, you're not spiritually dead, you're going to be a searching person. That's part of the equipment that a human being is born with, or should be born with. Now, this is one side of the equation. Man searches for God. The other side of it is that man's search for God cannot fully succeed. Man is finite, God is infinite. It's interesting that while in mapping out these various arenas in which search for God takes place, it plunders every philosophical argument on the face of the earth. The good, the bad, the ugly, it's all grist for the mill. If you would ask him, do the proofs of existence of God really work? They really establish, they prove the existence of God. He was rather skeptical about it. And in this respect, he was very much a post-Kantian. For him, he never said the proofs don't work. It was very clear that he had very little interest in the proofs. Meaning that even if they work, they're to some degree irrelevant. After Kant, it's really my formulation now rather than his, but after Kant, even if you can put together a proof and the proof is going to work, in terms of the way people really operate, it's going to be irrelevant. It's not going to determine where people are going. For the Rav, this was not a bad thing. Because you think that you have a proof that this is God that works, your concept of God will be limited by the nature of your proof. The post-Kantian awareness that the proofs can really tell you something about your own quest for God, but it can't really give you the bottom line that you're after, reinforces the awareness of the infinity of God. So that human quest, as important as it is, will fall short. Wherever the human being meets the limits of our finitude, be it, again, the way in which God transcends our conception of God, be it in the experience of evil, which we'll hear about more later, you hit a barrier. But there's another side to the story. It's not only man who is in search of God, it is also God who is in search of man. As in Shir HaShirim, the two figures, the man, the woman, they search after each other. It seems like a crazy relationship. And of course, one of them is looking for, A is looking for B, and B isn't home, and B is ready, and B looks for A, and A isn't, it's gone away already. This is a relationship between man and God. We search for God, and we can't reach him. Then, when we may not really be looking anymore, we may least expect it, the Ribono Shel Olam looks for us. The infinite erupts into our lives. Frequently, that is not going to be when we want it or how we want it. If that eruption of God into our lives can be frightening. In Egypt, a band of slaves, of people who were not particularly ready for spiritual uplift, were suddenly confronted. Even prophetic experience entails trembling, falling on one's face. It's frightening. It can be terrifying. The two sides. Fear and love. In love, the quest, you want to be closer to God. Fear, when God visits you, the desire to recoil, the sense of being overpowered. Now let me add that at every stage of this argument, that I may start from a description of experience, of the way people might experience the world, kind of purely philosophical approach, But at every point, he will stop and illustrate from halacha that this plays itself out in the halachic universe as well. Halacha for the Rav has two roles. Halacha is a guide. Halacha tells you what you're supposed to experience. It gives you a structure for experience. Halacha also, in effect, walks behind you and captures the reality of that experience. Halacha is both the vanguard, and what's the opposite of a vanguard? Hebrew, it's ma'aseh. Anybody with army background or a rear guard? Love and fear, remember, love and fear are mitzvot. These are not just aspects of human experience. They're aspects of human experience that become mitzvot. You're obligated to love God and to fear God. Love and fear of God can occur at several different levels. At the lowest level, which is the one we're discussing right now, love and fear can be very selfishly driven. In the beginning, human being can think of these things in purely selfish terms. Love means this is what I want, and fear means this is what I don't want. As one of my psychoanalyst friends says, "Bathala hakol metchil min hashad." Everything begins with the breast. You know, the breast is there, that's good. Breast is withdrawn, that's bad. You know, milk is good, pain is bad. And we can relate to God that way too. We quest for God because for whatever strange reason, there's something that we think is good. God will do something for us. We enjoy the experience. It gives meaning to our lives. Whatever the motivation might be. And the fear, you know, we're afraid of the demands of us. We're afraid of what he will do to us. The Rav does not regard those kinds of love and fear as invalid. They may be primitive, they're not invalid, because a human being, for the Rav, is a biological creature with all the givens of an animal. We're a very sophisticated animal, but an animal nonetheless. And he's not embarrassed by that. You see the new book, The Emergence of Ethical Man, and it goes on at great length to show how important it is for religion to place man in a naturalistic framework, together with the plant, together with the animal, and how the religious aspect is continuous with those other aspects of the human being. It's not as if spirituality is completely different, that has no relationship at all to the biological or psychological animal. Now, when we have this situation of God finding us, or God revealing himself to us, what does the relation mean in practical terms? And the answer is, revelation means to be commanded. The relationship between man and God that is created by God's revelation, by God finding the human being, is mitzvot. It's not an intellectual insight. It's not information about God. It's mitzvot. That's the only way the infinite God relates to finite man. Commands you. And again, this is not just an experiential element. It's a halachic element as well. Part of halacha is to remember Ma'amad Har Sinai, to remember when God came and gave you mitzvot, to remember the content of the mitzvot, and to remember the atmosphere, the fear and trembling that involved the mitzvot, that were involved in the mitzvot. You have then these two clashing experiences. From within the clashing experiences, there can then come a point of temporary equilibrium. The human being is searching for God. God confronts you not as your friend, but as your commander. God is not your co-worker. God is your sergeant. I'll use a military image. He's telling you what to do. And the only thing you can do in return is to obey. The only response for a human being under those circumstances is obedience. Either obedience or God forbid rebellion. Within that framework, though, there can come a point where there is already a synthesis between these two experiences, where you accept the commandment as a response to your quest for God. And then you continue your quest. You don't regard the quest as being in conflict with God's revelation. You regard the revelation as an opening for you to relate differently to God. And this leads, I'm being very quick about this, this leads to a second level, which is called imitation. And you have the relationship to the person you admire. Sometimes when I give a lecture in the United States, I use the example of a baseball player. Here, maybe, I don't know enough about hockey, but player you admire, you want to get close to him. At one stage, the only thing you can do is if he sees you out in the street and he says, "Hey, kid, here's a couple dollars. Get me a Coke. Get me some hot dogs." That's, you can do that for him. You can obey him. There can be another stage where you don't simply obey the person. You imitate. And again, with sports heroes, Lahavdil, that's something that we do. You don't simply say, "What does so-and-so want me to do?" You say, "I want to imitate that person." So you have imitation of God, which should have talked about already in Halachic Man. And that's part of the transition between these two essays. Imitating God. The Jew, the halachic person, is not simply obeying God, you are also imitating him. Again, this is something that is found in halacha. There's a mitzvah, like any other mitzvah, to imitate God. There's a mitzvah to fear God, a mitzvah to love God, a mitzvah to remember revelation of Hatsinai with all fear and trembling, and there's a mitzvah to imitate God. It's manifested, as you know, in the Rambam, in two places. One, the idea that certain particular practices we engage in are a fulfillment of imitating God, visiting the sick, burying the dead, and so on and so forth. In Hilchot Avelut, you have a list of these mitzvot. And it is also the case regarding certain personal traits. He is merciful, you be merciful, which the Rambam discussed in Hilchot Deot. But you have that level of imitating God. And imitating God is done through the mitzvah. And doing that would seem to alleviate the tension between, on the one hand, man's searching for God, a man's desire to be close to God, and on the other hand, a religion of pure obedience. So far, believe it or not, so far, I had figured all this out before Uvikashtim ever came out. Reading Yishalach, I saw imitation of God, I saw when you're the creativity of Yishalach as an act of imitation of God. I figured a lot of this out. Where I was very shocked when I first read Uvikashtem is when the Rav describes imitating God, and you think, this is it already. And then the Rav says, imitating God is another failure. I thought this is the promised land already. And I'm wondering what he's going to do for the next 50 pages. It's not finished yet. It's like one of these crime stories where they catch a murderer and you look at the watch and say, no, he can't be the murderer. It's only 9:40. It's another 20 minutes to go. But I've said imitation is not really a satisfying end to the story. Because even in imitation, there remains a huge gap between man and God. He even says imitation is almost a kind of resigned gesture where man is saying, you know, we really can't have a full communion with Ribbono Shel Olam. And therefore, you know, imitating him is some kind of halfway tactic. At least makes life tolerable. It at least overcomes some of the tension between our desire for self-fulfillment on the one hand and God's demands upon us on the other hand. There's another stage. That stage is called Dveikut. Now, Dveikut, adherence to God, you know, clinging, it's a hard word to translate. Adhesion, adherence. That's a very hard idea to digest. Again, it's a mitzvah. You go through a list of 613 mitzvot, V'davakta bo is a mitzvah just like any other mitzvah there. But I think we generally, at least before that point, I figured if you get to imitation of God, that's really going very far. You have fear of God. You have so many religious mitzvot, inwardly directed mitzvot, that V'davakta, maybe mystics have that, or... But the Rav isn't interested in mysticism. He's interested in a philosophy that is rooted in halacha. And a philosophy rooted in the notion that where man and God meet has to include behavior. It has to include halacha. It has to include intellect. It cannot be a mystical experience where people have an emotional high without the behavioral aspects, without the intellectual aspects. And to put it bluntly, if you think that I can go through a long essay without talking about study of Torah, you know, you don't know. And somehow, I mean, I've kept it out so far. Well, you know, the Sinai experience, there is something of that. I've skipped a little bit, but there has to be a lot more. So you have a difficult passage in Bikashtem, several pages, where he tries to work out the idea of Dveikut, but to work it out not in mystical terms and not in purely behavioral terms, but in terms of something that grows out of the kind of experiences we've had so far. I'll put it in the Rav's own language. The Midrash says, well, the Midrash said it before the Rav did. The Midrash said, how can you have Dveikut? Do we not know that God is consuming fire? How can you have this? Now, the answer that the Midrash gives is, well, if you can't adhere to God, cling to the scholars. That, of course, leaves several questions open. One is that, in the end, you are clinging to people and not to God. You can go from the question, what exactly do the chachamim do? You know, how do they cling? You know, so the Midrash, this is what Chazal are saying, but what it means philosophically is not at all clear. And the way that Rav puts it, if you're a mystic, you don't have to accept the Midrash. If you're a mystic, you can say, well, God is consuming fire. How can you cling to consuming fire? The answer would be simple. Let the fire come down and burn you. You're a mystic, you give up selfhood. If that's the price of being close to God, then give it up. But obviously it's not what Chazal is saying. Chazal say, you cling to God, you adhere to God by adhering to Talmid Chachamim, which, again, raises all the questions I raised before and sounds like a very artificial kind of answer. A friend of mine once put it, if you take that midrash literally, it means that the best thing in this world is to be salvechik. If you can't be one, then marry into the family. Let your daughter marry a Talmid Chacham. If you can't even do that, at least drive them to the airport once in a while. But clearly, this is not what it's about. By the time that Ub is finished, I'm not going to go through blow by blow because we don't have text in front of us. What that midrash ends up saying is, one, dveikut involves Torah study. It involves intellectual activity. Hidavek to lechamim doesn't simply mean hang out with Rashi Shiva. It means become part of a community of Torah study. It's an intellectual level. Number two, Hidavek b'talmidei chachamim also entails that dveikut must have a social aspect to it. It's not simply a matter of how much you know. If I know all Shulchan Aruch by heart, what do I need talmidei chachamim for? Hidavek b'talmidei chachamim means become part of a community of talmidei chachamim. I said before, become a member of a community of Torah study. I'm now saying become a member of a community of Torah study. The communal aspect is important. Unlike mystics, or many mystics, we don't idealize the person who sits alone on an ivory tower or on top of a mountain and communes with God. You're talking about a certain kind of community. Ultimately, that is a community in which, I'm skipping a few steps here, in which there is an equation, identification of action, thought, and will. Action, thought, and emotion. Which is a kind of ultimate imitation of God. In Ishalacha, the Rav said, just as God is creative, the Ishalacha is creative intellectually. As the Rambam said in many halachic areas, being a moral person means imitating God. As he is merciful, you'll be merciful. As he buries the dead, you bury the dead. Ultimately, though, in terms of Veikut, it means that just as for God, God's will, God's thought, and God's action are in harmony, that is a goal for the human being as well. That is what it means to lead a meaningful religious life. If you are leading that kind of life, you have communion with God insofar as you and God are essentially doing the same thing. You and God are part of a community. You create a community where God is welcome, where God is a participant. Again, that is rooted in halacha. Insofar as you are fulfilling specific mitzvot of fearing God, loving God, imitating Him, and vidavaktavo, it is rooted in halacha insofar as halacha creates that kind of community. And no other religious system that one can easily think of creates that same kind of community. If you're asking about the superiority of Yiddishkeit, I'm not here to preach, I'm not trying to convert anybody to Judaism here. It's purely academic discussion. But if you're asking, what does Yahadut provide that is not provided in quite the same way by our sister religion, so to speak, that kind of integration. The action, the thought, the intellectual world, the emotional world, and the action, all coming together in harmony and all involved in a dialogue with God. when you hear Rav saying, speaking about God being in a room with him when he's studying and so on and so forth, it sounds like some kind of emotional outpouring. What I'm telling you now is the intellectual backbone underlying it. Now, in the balance of the essay, I think we have 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Okay, yeah. In the balance of the essay, the Rav goes on to talk about the three media that facilitate things. I mean, it's one thing to define it, it's another thing to actually practice it. A lot of things you can define. Living it is not that easy. So what institutions does Yahadut provide? I won't need it. The Rav had the advantage that nobody else had, that he didn't have to look at the clock. It's a wonderful essay by Rabbi Lam that appeared in the Rabbinical Council Sermon Manual, of all places. It's probably reprinted somewhere else, about the giving a sermon. Rabbi Lam writes about what goes into giving a sermon, how he developed in that regard. It's a wonderful essay for anybody who's interested in public speaking or rabbinate. Wonderful, insightful essay. He said he modeled himself after the Rav, except there was one big difference, that the Rav didn't have to worry about the clock, and he did have to worry about the clock. So the Rav could, and I can't, I've trained myself to reasonable, my students know that if I'm supposed to speak for 10 minutes, it's really 10 minutes on the dot, and supposed to be 15 minutes and 15 minutes on the dot. It's supposed to be 100 minutes. It's 110 minutes on the dot. You know what I'm talking about. Anyway, since I've used some of the extra time it just gave me, but we'll finish on time. Where were we holding? We're talking about the facilitators. What institutions does Yahadut provide? What does Halacha provide that enables you to take this definition and turn it into a reality? Three. The first is the sovereignty of the intellect. Meaning, what means Torah study? It means that a religious framework that will enable you to have vekut in a way that we are defining has to take the intellectual gesture, a human being that is an intellectual being, among other things, and enable that intellectual gesture to attain dignity and recognition. So that's the sovereignty of intellect. Secondly, respect for the body. If you want vekut, you want that harmony of intellect and will and thought and action, you have to take bodily experience seriously. Which is kashrut, eating, sexual act, even going to the bathroom. All of these things have a religious significance. The halachic person or the person involved in vekut, even those acts play a role in the relationship with God. And lastly, what the Rav calls hatmadat hanivua, the perpetuation of prophecy. When the Rav talks about prophecy in this context, as part of theology, he is not interested exclusively or particularly in the experiences that a select group of people had 3,000 years ago. That's described in the Bible. So it's very interesting, but that's not what defines this activity from an existential point of view. He's not interested in prophecy as an antiquarian phenomenon. It happened once upon a time and isn't happening today. Hatmadat Dvar HaNevuah means that prophecy continues into today. It perpetuates itself. How is that? The study of Torah is not simply a matter of mastering a given text. The study of Torah has a creative element to it. The study of Torah takes place in a certain community. It's a community of tradition, a community of transmission. It is not merely repeating words written in a book. It's an oral Torah. And through that, we create a community that includes the past, the present, the future, and the Rabban Shalom. A living community. Rav Schachter spoke earlier about the sense of urgency that I felt in transmitting Torah. I think that may be less true of transmitting the content of Torah. The idea was simply to transmit the content of Torah. You can write popular halacha books. Or if you want to communicate a lot of Brisker Torah, you can give lectures in Brisker Torah. You can, you know, make a few hundred pages and drive it out. I'm speaking now from about 15, 20 years later than the period of Schachter is speaking. Well, maybe it's more like 10 years. By the time he left and I came, there wasn't that much. It was maybe 5 years gap. But the Rav, when he wanted to, could lecture like a university professor. And Schachter described that earlier. Okay? He'd come in and say, this is the definition of X. In 2 hours, you cover a huge amount of material. It's all organized, all clear. When he gave a public lecture, he could do the same thing, only more slowly, where everything went in order, beginning to end. Very often, the shiurim that I remember, at the time I didn't realize it. He was that good an actor that he didn't realize it. But if his purpose was to communicate the maximum amount of material, there are more efficient ways of doing it. Actually, we could say that Talmud study is inefficient because you get a summary, you get the cliff notes, it's easier to get through. What he was doing in the shir was not only transmitting material, it was transmitting a way of thought, or if I will quote Rav Schachter again, so you shouldn't think that I'm disagreeing with him, part of what he called, Rav Schachter called Shimush Talmidei Chachamim, means, and Rav Schachter didn't say it today, he said it in writing on other occasions, it means not only what the teacher is teaching, but how the teacher thinks. And with us, very often, I realize in retrospect that he sacrificed transmission of material in order to make us struggle with the material the way he did, or transmit a sense of a living experience. Did that succeed with everybody? I don't know. I think it succeeded in Gemara better than it may have done in philosophical areas, and better than he may have thought at the time. That sense of a community. At the end of Vikashtem, there's a passage which a lot of people like to quote. If you recall an article that appeared in the early 1980s, which tried to create a psychobiography of the Rav. He read it. He wasn't particularly impressed by it. He commented that while when it came to Isha Halacha, they seemed to know the article well. When it came to Vikashtem, they had very little to say, except this anecdote that I'm telling you now. And then the Rav said to me, can you imagine what will happen if I ever write something without any anecdotes in it? What will these people do? But it's a famous anecdote nonetheless. The Rav describes how, as a very small child, his father was living in Trujan with his wife's family, was eating kest, as it was called in those days, meaning that after the wedding, the wife's family supported him while he continued learning. So he was living there. He was giving a shir occasionally at home on Rambam. And the most Slovacic, more any other brisk, was really obsessed with the Rambam. You know, it's usually kind of hyperbole when we talk about other briskers. With him, it really seemed to be true, and everything revolved around the Rambam. And he was giving classes at home, and the Rav was in the crib in the next room. He was listening. He was listening to it. And the shiur always began with the Rambam. And then father would go through the Rambam and show that there were difficulties in the Rambam. And go through the Rambam and discuss other Rishonim and discuss. The other younger people would say what they thought, and father would say what he thought. And the Rav was in the crib listening to all of this. And he was not alone in the crib. The Rambam was there too. What did the Rambam look like? He wasn't quite sure, but he looked more or less like his father. After they were both named Moshe, and they were, you know. The Rambam was with him in the crib. And the Rav understood very well two things. One, it's a feature of the Rav's strange sense of humor that when he says these things, he'll actually put new numbers there, you know, one and two. The first thing was that the Rambam had a lot of enemies. There are a lot of people who had difficulties with the Rambam were out to get him. And the other thing, set number two, that the Rambam had one friend in the world. Father. And father would work at the Rambam, and he would resolve the Rambam, and everybody was happy. The Rav would jump out of bed, run to his mother, and say, you know, Mama, Mama, you know, father explained the Rambam. And his mother, you know, was pleased and went back to bed, and that was that. And there were times that it didn't work so easily. The difficulties remained. Father toiled, and everybody else toiled. And by the time it was over, father admitted, I have no solution here. And then the Rav would weep. And the Rambam would also weep. And he would get out of the crib and go get out of the bed and go to his mother and seek comfort from her. The Rambam has been defeated. And his mother would tell him, don't worry. Your father is resourceful. He may come up with something yet. And if he doesn't, maybe when you grow up, you'll do it. The Rav says, you'll laugh at me, you'll think this is, you know, a childish experience. And yeah, as an adult, my experience is a little bit different. The difference is that now it's not only the Rambam who's with me, now it's the Beinu Tam, there's a whole crew that are sitting with me. If I'm in a room, I'm in a shir, if I'm alone, there's a whole group tying past and present together. In other essays, the Rav describes the relationship that he has with younger people. And what do I have? I'm a 75-year-old man. What do I have in common with an 18, 20, 22-year-old? And again, you come together in this community, and this is a community where the Rabbanu Shel Olam is present as well. It speaks about the Rabbanu Shel Olam looking over his shoulder as he's learning. This is the intellectual backdrop to it. And the anecdote is not simply a charming little anecdote to the child, which is nicely written with a touch of humor, and which can be easily quoted either by psychologically oriented scholars or by people writing a book review in a popular newspaper. It's a story that is there for a particular purpose. It is there to develop a very important point, to try to encapsulate the essence of what is philosophically a very complex notion. I think I'm ready to stop at this point. I'm not running away, so we'll have more opportunities to discuss these matters. Thank you.